Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, and I'll be back with you on the Athletic Football Podcast from Monday. And this season, I'll be with you four times a week, bringing you the best insight into the best stories from across football. And if that isn't enough for you, Dan Bardell and George Ellick will bring you the weekend preview show every Friday as well. And here they are right now with their big season preview. Listen to that, enjoy it. I'll see you Monday.
The Athletic.
Premier League is back, and so is the weekend preview show on the Athletic Football Podcast. I'm Dan Bardell.
And I'm George Ellick.
And we'll be here every Friday across the season setting you up for the Premier League weekend with plenty of insight from the Athletic's brilliant writers along the way.
João Cancelo, midway inside the Villa half, plays it in the gap to Jesus. It reaches De Bruyne. De Bruyne into the penalty area. And it is!
Andrew Robertson for Nunez. What a brilliant finish. And that has finished off Manchester City. He's been a hit since he came from the bench.
Here's Xhaka, Gabriel's far post. And Xhaka looking towards the near post and helped in by Gabriel Jesus. But it's only taken him 13 minutes, but it's his first goal at Emirates Stadium in an Arsenal shirt.
Joining us today is a man who has been the subject of a big summer transfer move himself. Formerly the Athletic's Wolves correspondent, but now he's got to move to the bright lights of London. It's Tim Spears. Tim, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me on. Good to see you, gents.
Exciting transfer window for you, Tim. We'll get to some of the big games this weekend a little bit later, but as it's the eve of the season, we're going to start by looking at the bigger picture. And let's start with the title race, George. Is it a two-horse race again? Is it Man City's to lose?
Well, it's definitely Man City's to lose. Is it a two-horse race before a ball has been kicked? Probably not, but I think it's probably as close as it can be to that. That these two look so far clear of what the rest of the Premier League have to offer. And I don't think, even though there's clear positivity around most of the other clubs in terms of where they've been over the last couple of seasons, I think to bridge that gap, that quality gap between the two will be very difficult for any of them, as we'll come on to. In terms of the top two themselves, it feels to me like City was certainly deserving of their title last season, even though with a half an hour to go on final day, it looked like it might slip through their grasp. I think probably getting knocked out of the Champions League when they did do helped them refocus and ensure they got over the line in the Premier League. But it looks to me like on the eve of the season, even though, you know, Erling Haaland is probably one of the most exciting transfers we've seen into the Premier League for a long time, I would almost say that Liverpool feel to me in a more secure position in terms of their actual squad. I think when you look at Manchester City and the players that have left, you know, there's no denying that Raheem Sterling, Gabriel Jesus, Oleksandr Zinchenko and Fernandinho aren't necessarily the most important players for Manchester City. That still equates to 6,000 Premier League minutes last season. So, you know, 65, 66.
Dressing room characters as well.
That they've lost, and senior pros, and crucially, players that Pep Guardiola trusted to an extent and who knew the way that he wanted to play and brought some much needed depth. Bernardo Silva's clearly being linked to a move to Barcelona as well, who would be the most significant probably in terms of what he's offered and the amount of minutes played. So there's a concern for me about the depth at City, especially with the need for key signings to bed in quickly, which hasn't necessarily happened. Unlike Liverpool, where I know that Sadio Mane is going to be a huge loss, and we'll come on to that. But the succession planning feels to me to be a bit more aligned. You know, I think Fabio Carvalho is a brilliant signing who we may not see too much of this season. But in terms of the outside of the protagonists, having Jones, having Elliot, having Carvalho as those to step in, and Jota and Firmino probably playing second fiddle to the new front three as well. I just wonder if Liverpool are going into the season with more in terms of the depth of their squad, and that could mean there's a bit of a shift. So I'm not sitting here saying Liverpool are favourites to win it by any stretch, but I do think that the perception of City kicking on by cutting Deadwood and bringing in Haaland isn't necessarily how I'm viewing it.
Community Shield maybe influenced you a little bit as well.
No,
George, Tim.
Pre-season doesn't matter, Dan. We know that. Irrelevant.
Tim, who has had the better summer, in your opinion?
I think anyone who brings in Erling Haaland has probably won the transfer window.
Especially for such a low fee.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact that Liverpool have lost Mane just shouldn't be underestimated, and Darwin Núñez will score goals, but he's coming from what is a much weaker league than the Premier League, which I think does get overlooked sometimes. But I can definitely see it being a two-horse race. I just think both squads have sort of issues and variables going into the season, but they start at such a higher level than everybody else. And you can see certain players stepping up into the breach at City, like Grealish. Julian Alvarez looks pretty good in pre-season. I think Foden's going to have an absolutely massive season, I think. But they are slightly unbalanced. I mean, they're going into the season with only sort of two natural fullbacks, which is definitely an issue, but one you'd expect them to resolve in the next few weeks. I think a really important thing for Liverpool is that Mane's Senegal beat Salah's Egypt to qualify for the World Cup. I think if Salah had a World Cup in the middle of this, you know, we saw him drop off after the African Cup of Nations last season, but he's their main player. I expect him to score more goals than anyone else in the league. The fact that he has not a World Cup in the middle of it, and the World Cup makes this like I think a lot of people are predicting the same things to happen in the Premier League this season, and we may repeat those predictions today, but the World Cup makes this, for me, one of the most interesting seasons in recent years, because there's just so much unpredictability going to come out of those few weeks in Qatar, which makes all this, a lot of the second half of the season, almost impossible to predict, to be honest. I think from Liverpool's point of view, James Pearce made a really good point this week that for such an incredible squad and in an incredible era at Anfield and an incredible manager, they've still only won one Premier League and one Champions League, which just isn't enough for what they've got and what they've done. So I think there'll be a real inner determination to put that right this season, especially having come so close to both those trophies last year.
Yeah, and George, you touched on it, Sadio Mane, huge loss. Really, the second half of the season, Mane kind of took over from Salah as being the main goal scorer at Liverpool. Just how much of a loss is he overall? Because they've replaced him with a very different type of player.
He's definitely a big loss, I think. Because Salah has been so consistently good over the last few seasons, I think people have been a bit complacent as to how good Sadio Mane was and how important he was to Liverpool as well. I mean, it's interesting you say that he took on the mantle. I mean, he did, but the arrival of Luis Diaz meant that he had to, because Diaz then played on the left, where we were used to seeing Mane play, and Mane kind of moved into the central striking role and did very well. But I'm not necessarily convinced that's his best position or where he's best used either. And in that sense, I think bringing Diaz in as being, you know, he is younger, he's got more years, and his ceiling playing off the left is so high. Going and getting Núñez, and you know, they now have strength and depth in terms of both Firmino and Jota there as well. It feels like they've got more options than usual, whereas for three or four seasons, as good as they were, we knew it was going to be Firmino through the middle and Mane and Salah either side. That's not the case anymore. So I do think he's a loss, and certainly his goals are going to be hard to replace. A lot of Liverpool fans at the turn of the year were saying that they wanted to see the back of him, and I'm not sure that's entirely fair, but the players they brought in have been successful, and what sets Liverpool apart from me than City in terms of their recruitment is just how crazily quickly their players seem to settle in there, whether it was Jota coming in and making an immediate impact, whether it was Diaz doing the same last season. City's players seem to take at least a season to be able to get up to speed, whereas players who haven't necessarily shown that level of form before being taken on by Liverpool seem to raise their game immediately. And I'm excited. I'm not suggesting by any stretch that long-term, Núñez is a better signing than Haaland, but it wouldn't surprise me if, at least at the start of the season, he takes to life in the Premier League a bit quicker than Haaland, who may have to, either he'll have to adapt or City will have to adapt to play to his strengths.
Yeah, talking of like hitting the ground running, how the Liverpool players come in so quickly, Tim, and do seem to acclimatise to what Liverpool do. You know, Luis Diaz last season, literally, as George says, it was like he'd been there his whole career. He just fitted in straight away. The fact that he's done that and he's now coming into his first full season. You know, Mane's gone, but Luis Diaz is probably ready to take over that role full time.
Yeah, you'd probably expect him to kick on again. And again, he's another player who doesn't have a World Cup in the middle of the season, which again will be pretty important.
Yeah.
You can say that for most clubs. You know, Haaland's obviously not going either for City, but I think the fact that Luis Diaz and Salah aren't going will definitely be in Liverpool's favour. I mean, there are a couple of issues with the forward line in that, you know, Firmino's 30 now. How much of an influence can he really still have in that squad? Jota starts the season injured. Looks like he's going to be out for a few weeks. So you know, if Darwin Núñez doesn't hit the ground running, then you are just relying on Salah and Diaz, and there maybe is a little bit of a weakness there. And there are question marks over the midfield, although Klopp is adamant that there is absolutely no doubt in his mind that they don't need to sign a midfielder, and there are absolutely no issues there, which I guess you'd expect him to say. But there are certainly, you know, fitness and injury issues there. But overall, you know, we're trying to pinpoint weaknesses here in Liverpool and Man City squads, but just look how good they were last season. You'd expect the same again. You really would.
Yeah, I think in terms of the midfield as well, I think this is going to be a big season for Harvey Elliott, who I think Klopp does see as playing on the right-hand side of the midfield three rather than in an advanced role. I think the arrival of Carvalho as well, who will be, given the way that Liverpool play, you know, at Fulham he played as a 10. They don't play with a 10. I can't see him playing as a false nine in between the two wide players. So I think he will be Salah's understudy, effectively probably coming on for minutes later on in the game. And the fact that Carvalho has been brought in, I think, just shows that Elliott is being seen as being a playmaker on the right-hand side of the midfield in front of Fabinho. And I think for Elliott and for Jones, this is a huge season. You know, I'm a big fan of Curtis Jones. I think he's shown in flashes how good he can be. I think he's going to get a lot of minutes this season. And for Elliott, off the back of his injury, where he doesn't seem to, you know, he still seems to be the same player after that serious injury, which is fantastic news for Liverpool fans and for Elliott. This has got to be the season where he begins to get regular starts playing in that midfield three. And he's, you know, he's so incredibly talented, both in terms of his passing ability and his ball carrying ability as well. So, maybe if those two players do step up, then the midfield options will look more impressive in a few weeks. And I from Klopp's point of view, not going out and signing someone who would take their minutes, I think has to be a smart idea.
Yeah, give him credit for that as well. Jurgen Klopp, Alexander Arnold and Harvey Elliott had quite a good link-up, I thought, at the start of last season, so it'd be intriguing to see whether that happens again. Now, football often works in cycles and patterns, and Liverpool and Man City have probably been at the front of this in the last few seasons. So they were both operating, really, with false nines for the last few years, Manchester City and Liverpool, Tim. They're now playing with these really different types of strikers, and I guess that's what's exciting going into this season, is that we're seeing the two best teams, who've been the best by an absolute country mile, kind of reinvent the way they do things. So seeing them playing with two proper number nines, that is going to be interesting at the start of the season.
Yeah, you're right. And that's exactly the kind of, you know, tactical adaptation you'd expect from managers like Guardiola and Klopp. And I think how they adapt to Haaland and Nunes and how the players adapt to the clubs is probably going to define, you know, certainly the first half of the season. I mean, Grealish was a £100 million signing last summer and didn't exactly hit the ground running and found himself out of the team. Does Guardiola do the same if Haaland doesn't hit the ground running? You know, is he dropped? You know, you wouldn't put past Guardiola doing that. And it is going to be a massive change from how they play. And, you know, you take someone like Raheem Sterling out of that squad as well, very influential in the way that City played, getting to the byline and cutting the ball back for so many years. So, yeah. That adaptation is going to be key in how they do, certainly the first half of the season.
Is it a two-horse race? Are we talking literally these two teams? I actually think the gap will be closer this year between the chasing pack and the top two. I think those two, Manchester City and Liverpool, are obviously the standout teams. But I look at Spurs, I look at Arsenal and the way they've done business so far in the summer. I don't envisage the gap being as large, but I realise I could look very stupid come May saying that now.
I think, as Tim said, the World Cup certainly could provide a level of randomness that we're not normally used to seeing. We have absolutely no idea what impact it will have having a tournament in Qatar halfway through the season. And it's going to be random which players are knocked out in the group stages and get to go home early, and which club has benefited by that. Which, you know, we mentioned Salah here, who I think, you know, it's a great point that he's going to have a rest in the middle of the season whilst everyone else is going out and playing football in a really competitive World Cup. So I think in early August, making sweeping statements about who can do this and who will do this is only one way to look foolish. You know, we only have to go back to this time last year, Dan. We were sitting here doing the first ever one of these podcasts and Chelsea were second favourites to win the league and we're seeing as the closest thing to Manchester City.
I'm Adam first favourites.
There you go. You know, and that just goes to show how quickly things can change in football, and also the fallibility of buying too much into what is a very small sample size at the end of a season. You know, a lot of Spurs fans anticipate that they are going to be as strong as they were at the back end of last season. I'm fairly positive on their chances as well. But then you've also got Arsenal fans who look at their pre-season and think, wow, you know, look at our recruitment. It's so much narrative driven rather than actual evidence based on what we're going to see this season at this stage. So I think those two teams will finish in the top two. But anyone saying right now it will be those two, no one can get near them. They might be right at the end of the season, but it's too early to say, especially because of the quirks of the World Cup.
The other thing to say about the World Cup, I mean, it's not just a tournament put in the middle of a season. It's potentially the pinnacle of a player's entire career, you know, coming up in a few weeks or months. So you're going to have a situation where players are going to be unhappy at being on the bench in the opening weeks of a season. You know, I'm reading this morning about Mr. Wolves, Connor Cody, potentially leaving the club because he doesn't want to harm his World Cup chances, which is sort of unthinkable, really. But the World Cup throws in that huge curveball. You know, looking towards the end of October, early November, players aren't going to be wanting to get injured. You know, are they going to be flying into tackles? Are they going to be playing at 80%? And then the tournament itself obviously throws up form, fatigue, injury, mental come downs, you know, from losing finalists, losing semi-finalists. You know, I think we saw that with England players after the Euros at the start of last season. Quite a few start the season really slowly. So inevitably, when England don't win the tournament, that's going to happen again.
No, let's not have that.
But I do think it's absolutely farcical that this is happening. But it will definitely make for a more interesting and unpredictable domestic season, in my opinion.
Yeah, we saw it with Salah as well, didn't we, in the African Cup of Nations, losing the final. He did feel like he was a bit of a different player when he came back from that. Right then, two away trips for these two. Liverpool are at Fulham and City are travelling to West Ham. Do we expect them both to start with a win?
Yeah, I think so. I think for Liverpool going...
Do you think with City? I don't think that's guaranteed. That's a tough game, West Ham away, first game.
It's definitely a tough game. I think Scamacca is a very good signing for West Ham, and therefore playing West Ham before, you know, their £50 million star striker is probably going to be up to speed to be able to play. It's got to be quite a good time to play them. Similarly, I think Fulham are going to be very busy in the transfer market over the next 3 or 4 weeks. So I anticipate both Fulham and West Ham will be stronger come September. And if there's a good time for... There's nothing, obviously, for Liverpool or City to fear going to either of them. But I think if there's a good time to play them, they might have found it.
Yeah, they'll both win, Dan, definitely.
Okay, clip that up, get it ready for Monday on The Athletic's Twitter feed. Remember, you can sign up to The Athletic for just £1 per month for the first 6 months and sample the best sports writing in the business, as well as ad-free versions of all our podcasts. Just visit theathletic.com/footballpod.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Time now to look at the battle for the top four. And George, Spurs under Conte, I think, are looked at as the strongest at the moment. They've had an incredible transfer window. They obviously pipped Arsenal to fourth last season. What would be a good season for Tottenham Hotspur?
They've got to finish in the top four. It feels to me like a squad that's being built for now, not for the future. They're not going to get much better than Antonio Conte. We know that Conte isn't somebody to nest. You know, I don't think he's going to be at Spurs for too long. So if they're going to achieve under him, it probably has to be in the next couple of seasons. You look at the players that they brought in this summer. I think they've had a great summer, but the likes of, you know, Bissouma, even though he's going to be injured for the start of the season, seemingly today, is someone who should, well, he will improve them immediately. Perisic is quite clearly a fairly short-term signing that's, you know, a fair bit of outlay for what is going to be a short-term reward for him. And similarly with Richarlison, someone who's going to come in, offer them something different in the final third, but is going to be expected to impact the squad immediately. So given the way they finished last season, given that they've got probably the best manager outside Klopp and Guardiola, possibly in Europe, especially in terms of getting short-term results. And to add to that, the fact that, you know, the players they brought in January, Kulusevski being the highlight, but still being at the club as well. If Spurs finish outside the top four, I think it would be a really, really disappointing season for them.
This is your patch now, Tim. Spurs impressed with their business?
I think they're nailed on for top four, to be honest. With the business they've done, they've really cemented themselves as the third best team in England, or the third best squad in England anyway. And Conte just gives them a massive edge, an edge over Arteta, over Ten Hag, and even over Tuchel for me. You know, I mean, this is Premier League winning manager.
Do you put Conte in the same bracket as Klopp and Pep?
Yeah, probably, I think. Yeah. He knows how to win trophies, he knows how to win titles.
He's a different breed to those two, isn't he, I guess, in a way?
Yeah, slightly.
Elite manager, though. Yeah. Elite manager.
And also, I think if you look, he's done it with Inter. I think Inter had finished between fourth and ninth for eight seasons in a row. And Conte came in and took them to second, and then he took them to first. So he'll be looking to do that now with Spurs. The fact that they've signed Richarlison and he's not a guaranteed starter is a game changer for me in terms of how we view Spurs. You know, George mentions Perisic and Bissouma as well. Christian Romero being touted to have a very big season. I think they can finally legitimately fight for a trophy this year and probably maybe go deep in the Champions League and looking at top four as well. You know, that's how highly I'd rate the squad and the manager.
Yeah, perhaps from the outside looking in at the moment, Chelsea, who we've already covered, were, you know, we saw them as challengers last season. They weren't at all. But now a lot of people, George, are talking about them not even making the top four this season. I guess it'd be easier to judge them at the end of the transfer window. But I think just by virtue of the way they're set up at the moment, Todd Boehly, in quite the unique position of he's in charge of transfers and he's dealing with transfers at the moment, it's quite hard to gauge Chelsea, I think.
Yeah, it really is. I think people overestimated them last season off the back of winning the Champions League. And I think people might be slightly underestimating them coming into this campaign. You know, it wasn't long ago they, in my view, outplayed Real Madrid over two legs in the Champions League and were very unlucky not to progress in
here that, he is again on the in, attack in against Ancelotti. It's not taken long.
I didn't mention his name.
I know what you were doing.
I think people, you know, you look at the Lukaku signing last season, that was an unmitigated disaster, but realistically, the loss of Lukaku isn't going to impact them because he didn't add anything to the on the pitch last season anyway. Sterling is a wonderful signing. You know, Sterling is somebody who there's no reason why he won't have his best years of his career at Chelsea. He's still age 27. He's almost had to play second fiddle for City throughout his whole time there. And I feel like coming into a club now where he looks to me to be the main goal threat this season. He will play as many minutes as he wants to play. Should be a very good signing. There does seem to be some concerns in terms of their preparation in this campaign. I still very much believe that a bad pre-season means nothing when it gets to the actual campaign. I heard, I was on the radio on Saturday with, I think it was Neil Taylor, who said that actually, in his view, a bad pre-season is the best thing that can happen because it gives the manager something to work on. It's when you're blowing teams away in pre-season. You walk into the campaign thinking you're bulletproof, and then you come up against sides who are at it, and you realise that actually you haven't been able to work on any of your issues at all. Thomas Tuchel's proven himself to be, at the very worst, a very capable manager, and I think he, at his best, can set up Chelsea to be such a solid defensive team as well. They've lost defenders. I don't think Christensen's a massive loss. I think Koulibaly is a great signing. So I don't necessarily expect them to challenge the top two, but I do think that the idea that Chelsea are in disarray, despite bizarre ongoings off the field last season, are a bit premature. They've still got the core of a very good squad. They've added a couple of great players, and they've got a manager who we know is proven at the top level in European football.
Do you think they need a striker, Tim?
Yeah, they do. You know, George is absolutely right about the defence, but goals would be a slight concern for me for Chelsea. And they're just, Chelsea have two good seasons and then one when they implode. So I guess that's why probably a lot of people are saying it.
I think it is
a bit strange that everybody's sort of tipping them to have a bad year. There's so much quality in that squad. The thing with Sterling is, and you can maybe say this for Jesus and Zinchenko as well, you know, they're players that Guardiola's happy to let go. So are they players that would then help bridge the gap for teams below towards City? You know, in Guardiola's mind, certainly not. But you would expect, if Sterling's the main man at Chelsea, then he will flourish. But it's a new era. If Tuchel doesn't start the season well, how does Boehly approach it? You know, we know how Abramovich would approach it. Does Tuchel get a long amount of time to repair any damage that's done? There's a lot of unknown factors at Chelsea, and I guess that's why a lot of people are saying that they might struggle this year. But, you know, so much quality in that squad, they should definitely be aiming for fourth place minimum.
And George, you've said pre-season means absolutely nothing, but Manchester United, what they have done in pre-season under Ten Hag, it looks like they actually have some kind of system in place now and a way of playing, which is something that's been devoid of Manchester United for so long now. Personally, I don't think top four is on the agenda for Manchester United at all this season. But I think if I was a Manchester United fan, I'd want to see some signs of just progress and having those patterns of play and just going out and having a plan. And I think at the very least, so far in pre-season, Manchester United look like they have those things.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is the key here. I think it could be very harsh on Erik ten Hag to expect him to come into what has effectively been a bit of a burning mess for the last 10 years and expect him to come in and immediately reroute them as other teams progress alongside. The squad itself hasn't had too much surgery. There's still a lot of deadwood there who I'm sure won't be there in a couple of years' time. The Eriksen signing is smart. You know, he's still a player who has so much quality. But having said that, the idea of Eriksen and Bruno Fernandes in the same team, especially if it's Ronaldo playing up front, doesn't fill me with too much positivity in terms of what they can do off the ball. And the Ronaldo situation is a massive negative as well, where I'm not entirely sure he is the right person to play up front for them anyway, even though his goal tally will always be good. But given that he is quite clearly not happy at the club, and when you look beneath Ronaldo, their striking options are seemingly still Anthony Martial and Marcus Rashford, it becomes quite difficult to make a case for them to be anywhere near the likes of Spurs and Chelsea, in my view. So I think the best possible scenario for Manchester United fans is that come May, there is, as you say, a discernible style of play, a clear idea and blueprint from the football club as to how they're going to progress over the next couple of seasons, and a fan base that are fully behind Ten Hag to be the person to lead that.
They've obviously been chasing De Jong all summer, who would be a pivotal part of what Ten Hag is trying to do. Without that kind of player, the system may fall down a little bit. But again, I'd be quite encouraged as a Manchester United fan that they seem to be all in on De Jong. And if they don't get him, it looks like they may not panic and just get someone in for the sake of it.
I'm not really encouraged by anything that Man United do, to be honest. I think the question for Man United is, have they hit rock bottom yet? I think was it their lowest Premier League points tally last season, 58, yeah. I think. Goal difference of zero, which is astonishing for the players they've got, the money they've spent. It's absolutely scandalous. And for us to be kind of saying, you know, if Man United play some coherent football and have a plan for what to do with their club is progress, it just shows you how far they've fallen. And I think the fan base, yeah, would settle for that, for players who want to play for the shirt. Martial up front, I think he scored one for Man United and one for Sevilla last season. You know, Rashford, just I haven't seen any of him in pre-season, but going on what him and Martial have done for the last 2 years, then yeah, where are the goals going to come from? So, you know, you've got Ronaldo being subbed at half time and going home last week. You've got Dean Henderson's comments in the week. I thought,
yeah,
not
cutting.
So this is about so much more than a head coach. And you know, I like the look of Ten Hag, and I think he'll improve the team, but there's so much more to do with the whole club than that. So there's lots that need sorting before we can start talking about Man United being a top four challenger for me.
Nightmare first game for them as well.
I was going to say, you say about rock bottom, obviously that 4-0 defeat to Brighton last season towards the back end was probably somewhere near rock bottom. They've got Brighton on the first day of the Sunday 2 o'clock kickoff at home this time. So that might be a decent barometer if there's an improvement, George.
Yeah, it will be. If they get beat 3-0, I guess you can say that's improvement. But it's a nightmare first game in my view. You've got a team in Brighton who, you know, they're going to be one of the best coached teams, well-drilled teams, playing a style of football that you know is so easy on the eye. I think for United fans watching on, if things don't go to plan, they'll be wondering, you know, especially because of the perceived minnow status of Brighton compared to Manchester United, what's going wrong? And I expect Brighton to give them a massive game. I think Brighton are 5-1 to win the game, which seems like a massive price about a team who, you know, are proven quality at this level. It won't help that that Welbs will be up front for Brighton if things don't go to plan for United fans. But I think it's a really tough ask first up for United to turn up and beat them. But similarly, and there's another, I think Arsenal's first game is a similar test, where if things do go to plan and go right, then to go and beat a team who beat you 4-0 just a couple of months ago on opening day and do it resoundingly is a good way to kick off the season. So high risk and high reward.
Yeah, Arsenal kick off the Premier League season team trying to banish those ghosts of Selhurst Park from last season. I'm impressed with Arsenal. I think this time last year,
don't fall almost, for pre-season, Dan.
No. I'm not. I didn't get what Arsenal were trying to do. I was on podcasts and I was slating them. Then as the season went on, I started to get a bit more of an understanding, Tim, of what they were trying to do, and could see where they were coming from. And their business this summer, I think they've made some fantastic signings.
Yeah, they have. To add to what they've got, and I really enjoyed watching them last season. You know, that forward line, the interchanging and the fluidity. And the goals that they can produce. I think Saka's going to have a really big season. Odegaard being given the captaincy is a really interesting move. And again, he's one that you'd be looking for them to kick on. Saliba coming in at the back. Zinchenko and Tierney, different options at left back. Martinelli you'd expect to kick on. That's the thing with Arsenal is their ceiling of potential is higher than a couple of the clubs around them. They were very inconsistent last year. They obviously started the season disastrously, ended the season poorly, but at parts in the middle they were blistering really. And I was at the Emirates when they beat Wolves 2-1 with a last minute winner, and it was without, and the Emirates rightly gets a bit of stick for being a bit quiet and being like a bit of a theatre, but it was one of the noisiest football stadiums I've ever heard. Actually, you can really sense the momentum and the togetherness, and the fact that they've stuck with Arteta should breed consistency, I think, for them this season. And I predict a similar season, you know, being on the sort of cusp of the top four, which will be successful for them.
That's the big six covered, George. Is the big six about to become a big seven? How far away are teams like Newcastle?
Well, Newcastle, I think, are the ones, aren't they? I mean, coming into this season, there are some very concerning noises around Leicester, where the recruitment or kind of lack of it, and the players who might be on the way out, the James Maddison to Newcastle story has all the ingredients of a saga that will go on till the end of the window. And, you know, Tim will know better than me, but it feels like these bids don't really happen unless there is some kind of encouragement from the player, especially between two clubs of similar stature. So I'm pretty happy to draw a line through Leicester as it stands, especially because, you know, Brendan Rodgers, the arc of a Brendan Rodgers managerial tenure seems to tail off quite quickly. And I think we started to see that last season. And if Fofana leaves as well, it could be really difficult for them. I mean, West Ham do incredibly well to keep up the pace, and I'm sure they'll be there or thereabouts again. But, you know, Newcastle, I think we can be pretty convinced they'll continue to recruit through the window. I think we can be pretty convinced they'll recruit in January as well. And it's hard for them now to go out and sign a whole team of Bruno Guimaraes or you know, of Botmans as well because of their stature. But as they improve, that will become easier, and they have the financial power to do so. So I think they are the closest. But as it stands at the moment, I wouldn't necessarily expect them to break in this season. Although I have doubts both about Manchester United and about Arsenal as well. I think Arsenal not being able to break into the top four without any European football was a huge blow for them. And back in the Europa League this season, I think they might struggle, despite the good signings. I have a feeling that they might struggle to repeat that trick again.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's look now at the relegation picture. George, you're an EFL expert. Feels a little bit samey for Bournemouth and Fulham in that they feel a bit verbatim to me at the moment to go down. Forest, I think I've got higher hopes for. What shape do those three sides find themselves in going into the 22-23 season?
Yeah, it's interesting that the parallels between Fulham and Bournemouth are being drawn by a fair few people. And we've seen both Scott Parker and Marco Silva come out in the press in the last week or so and basically complain about where the side is, saying that they're miles off it. In the case of Bournemouth, you can see it. I wasn't a massive fan of Bournemouth in the Championship last season. The recruitment in January seemed to get them over the line, but I'm not convinced they have a squad good enough to be battling out for survival. Very few teams coming up from the Championship are able to not really strengthen and do so. And you look at the business they've done. They brought in Joe Rothwell, who's a good Championship midfielder, but he's at age 27, never played in the Premier League before. You have Ryan Fredericks, who is injured at the moment and again has never really proven himself at the level either. And Marcus Tavernier, who is a player I like at Borough, but again, going out and signing a lot of Championship players when you've just been promoted out of the league doesn't strike me as the way to go about it. And I think Parker's concern is well-founded. I think as it stands at the moment, they have the weakest squad, a manager who's overseen one relegation in one season from the Premier League already. So I'd be very concerned about them. With Fulham, not so much. I think Marco Silva gets a lot of disrespect, and I'm a big fan of him as a manager. I think he did a fantastic job in the Hull relegation season, even though people will tell you that he got them relegated. He came in, halfway through the season and improved them massively. At Watford, he did a decent job until his head was turned. And then you look at the job he did at Everton, where since he's left that club, it's only gone one way since then. And suddenly being sacked when you're, I think he was eighth when he was sacked in the Premier League, doesn't look quite as bad as it does today. And he was magnificent last season at Fulham. Just realise that the way to build a team at Fulham is to get the ball onto Alexander Mitrovic's head as much as possible, or let them double up on Mitro and give the ball to Harry Wilson to cut inside and shoot. And that led to a lot of goals and a lot of points and winning the league really comfortably. They've made a couple of fairly big money signings from Europe that I'm not going to pretend I've seen much of, but I think having Mitrovic, who is definitely good enough in the right system to score goals, in my point of view, in the top flight, being managed by Silva, in my opinion, should make them competitive. And
don't
I think
fall into that Mitrovic trap again, George.
No.
Don't, the third time.
You're falling into the trap. You are falling into the trap of not seeing that this is a different side. And unlike Scott Parker, who cast Mitro aside after about six games when he hadn't scored yet, I've got no doubt that Silva will be continuing to keep the faith with him, even if things don't start too well. And with Forest, I mean, it feels quite Fulham two seasons ago, doesn't it, where they've gone out and they have spent, and all credit to them, they have realised that they have to support Steve Cooper in giving him a team and a squad who are good enough to survive. You know, the loss of Jed Spence will be huge. He was on loan last season from Borough, who's now gone to Spurs. But I think going out and getting Nico Williams is a really smart bit of business, and somebody who, you know, at the age he's at now, £80 million for a guy who's got his skill set at right wing back or right back is a bit of a snip, to be honest, given where he could go. And Cooper is a brilliant manager as well. For Forest as a club, you know, they're outside the top flight for far, far too long for their fans, and they seem pretty intent on not leaving any stone unturned to try and survive. And they were, you know, they started the season last season under Chris Hughton incredibly poorly. But as soon as Steve Cooper came in, they were the second best team in the Championship, if not the first, alongside Fulham. So definitely reasons to be positive. But I think if there's a trap to be had in this relegation chat, it is just assuming that Forest going out and spending tens of millions of pounds on new players is the absolute certainty to stay up. It has to work. And we've seen plenty of times that strategy falling short. So pretty negative about Bournemouth, fairly positive about both Fulham and Forest. But I think people are maybe expecting a bit too much of Forest and just underrating Fulham a little bit based on what they did last season.
I think Forest might do a Brentford and be relatively comfortable come the end of the season, but we shall see. Now, it's like the producer's reading my mind a little bit with this next bit. He's listed Leeds, Everton, Southampton and Wolves, Tim, as Oops. Those who look like they might struggle this season. Did you dismiss Wolves out of hand? Because I think there's a few worries there. That's not my Villa bias.
And this isn't my Wolves bias, but I've predicted Wolves to finish seventh this year. So
seventh?
Wow.
I thought my Villa eighth was kind.
They were top six for most of last season. People forget. They did fall away absolutely disgustingly with relegation form for the last couple months of season, but I'm excited about this. I know other people might not be, but Wolves have changed formation this summer. They've played 3-4-3 for 6 years, and they've finally gone four at the back, having only scored a goal a game for the last two seasons, Dan, which I've watched every single one of those games. It's not been fun, let me tell you. But yeah, they've gone four at the back now.
Beat Villa a fair few times, though.
So they're finally unleashing Neto, Pedence, Jimenez, possibly Gibbs-White as well, who's looked good in pre-season. Yeah. So they've got some, and you know, Neves pulling the strings, still there. Fully expected him to leave, but he hasn't. And then the sign of Nathan Collins from Burnley, you know, should help with that transformation to four at the back, certainly. So Bruno Lage, probably an underrated and still very unknown manager, but I do fancy Wolves to have a decent season.
Is Neto the player he was before the injury?
He certainly wasn't last couple of months of last season, but he, again, pre-season's not the barometer, but the fact he looks fully fit and he's scoring goals and looks confident would certainly suggest so. And yeah, people might have forgotten really, but that pandemic season, he was by far and away Wolves' outstanding player. And people I know who've worked very closely with him and Diogo Jota rate Neto as the better player, or certainly the one with the high potential. And I'd agree with that from what I've seen. So if Jimenez can get back to some kind of level that he was at before, then Wolves could surprise a few this season.
I think this time last year on our preview show on this podcast, I said that I thought Rafinha would be the, you know, if he stayed fit and played a lot, would be the breakout star and would get a big move. I think if Neto stays fit and is that player previously, I think he'll be the one next summer where I can see all the elite clubs in Europe wanting him. He's that pace coupled with that ball carrying ability and the quality in the final third is pretty rare. But I just worry about your goals, especially with Raul Jimenez, obviously injured to start the season as well, and top scorer with 6 last season.
Handbrake's off, George, though. Handbrake's off.
Interesting. Everton are the one I'm most worried for in that
Me
list.
Too.
I think they're in big trouble. And, you know, because by nature of losing Richarlison, I'm not knocking Dwight McNeil. But that isn't a lot for a lot of replacement. Alisson scored a Premier League goal more recently than Dwight McNeil. Which probably tells you everything it needs to know. And Richarlison scored the goals that kept Everton up. So I've got Everton to go down currently. But I think there's a team missing from that list of potential candidates.
On Everton... quickly, because also they've got 2 strikers effectively. One of them is Dominic Calvert-Lewin, one of them is Salomon Rondon. And news yesterday that Calvert-Lewin is both out
the first game, aren't they?
Exactly. So, you know, you're asking it. I'm not Frank Lampard's biggest fan as a manager, and I think you're asking a hell of a lot of him to get the season off to any kind of start that's going to preserve his job. And they're currently pressed up as 7-2 for relegation. I think if they were, based on the evidence of the last 2 years at Everton and the players they've got, the squad they've got and everything else, I think if their name was... if it was Burnley, just rename the club, there'd be a shorter price. I think they're still perceived as being a big club, which of course they are, but that doesn't matter when it comes to relegation. They are not too good or too big to go down.
Yeah, and what I'm about to say probably moves us quite nicely onto the sack race, the managerial section, Tim. I think Leicester are missing from that list. I feel like they're in absolute disarray at the moment. They could potentially have the core of their side ripped out. They've lost a massive leader in Kasper Schmeichel. Brendan Rodgers was very, very vocal in that he wanted incomings this summer. He's got none. I spent more on my Tesco's meal deal than Brendan Rodgers has spent in this transfer window yesterday. So, you know, there's big problems at Leicester, and I've seen it with Villa. If you get the core of your side ripped out, there's tensions behind the scene, you can easily find yourself in a relegation battle. And I would think at the moment, I've got Rodgers down as the favourite to be the first manager to leave. I feel like he might walk, Tim.
I feel like you've outlined it really well there. And, you know, one of the shining lights going into the season for Leicester would be someone like Fofana, who you'd think would be guaranteed, you know, for this to be his massive breakout Premier League season, because he missed so much of last year through injury. And now we're hearing that, you know, potentially he might want to leave as well. And if Maddison goes...
Tielemans has only got a year left as well.
Exactly. Well, they've got an awful lot of players out of contract next summer, including Johnny Evans, Jamie Vardy. Obviously, Schmeichel was one as well. Tielemans, like you say, asking a lot of Harvey Barnes. Patson Daka might have a better season, but there are problems everywhere for Leicester. I mean, for them to go into this season having made no signings, not just after Rodgers said, I think in May, that he was sort of wanted 5 or 6, but after what he said in February when they got thrashed by Forest in the FA Cup, and he basically questioned the desire of his squad and said, you know, these are not top players. You know, I need more. You know, these players aren't good enough for me. For them not to sign anyone is astonishing. So they are in big trouble, and I completely agree that Rodgers could be on the endangered species list, but potentially he could walk.
Would you go along with that, George?
Yeah. I mean, he's 15-2 for be the first manager to leave, and I think it's with the absence of a Watford manager in there. I think that's a fair price. Yeah, I completely agree. I would say on the keeper side of things, Daniel Leverson, who's spent the last couple of seasons on loan at Preston, at Rotherham before that, he's very good.
Ward's been injured, hasn't he? So I think Everson might start the season.
Even if they were both fit to start the season, I've got no doubt that Everson would be number one pretty soon. I mean, he's a proper shot stopper, like very, very good. I think he won all the awards at Preston last season as well. He's someone who there seems to be some consternation amongst neutrals as to why Leicester have let Kasper Schmeichel go without bringing in a replacement. The replacement is already there, as far as I can see. But Leicester were very poor, and I mentioned it before. You know, Brendan Rodgers has, we've seen this before with the way that he comes into a club, improves them gradually, then has a kind of rapid rise, and then things tail off very quickly. And normally by this stage of the arc, he's left. So I don't know what happens next. You know, does it keep going down, or is there something of a, do they turn that around? It strikes me that given the players that he wanted and the prospect of such key players leaving, you know, if Tielemans, Fofana and Maddison all walk out the door in the next 3 weeks, the amount of work that is needed, the amount of surgery that's needed, is huge. And they're 16-1 for relegation, which is definitely worth a bit of a flyer in case things really, the wheels do fall off. Because if those players want to leave, they'll leave. There's no question about it. Just on the sack race, there's one that I want to put up at a big price.
Go on,
Mikel Arteta's 33-1. I think for Arsenal going to Palace on the Friday night on opening day, Patrick Vieira's Palace is a nightmare, because if that goes wrong again, as it did last season, where we saw Vieira's Palace give them the runaround and beat them 3-0. If that happens again, because you know that Arsenal fans want Vieira to be their manager at some point, and especially over what we saw last season, I think Patrick Vieira is one of the most exciting young managers we've seen in the Premier League for a long time in terms of the style of football that he plays, his willingness to give youngsters a chance as well. The recruitment under him, whether it's got anything to do with him or not, has been magnificent. I know Dougie Friedman's the in charge of recruitment, but it's been a development of Crystal Palace Football Club under Vieira's tenure has been superb. So if things don't start well on Friday night, we saw last season how poor Arsenal were on opening day against Brentford as well. I'm by no means, I'm not sitting here thinking that they are going to lose. My only idea is that if things do get off to a rocky start, especially with Arteta having been Arsenal manager for so long now without really much to show for it as well, I just wonder if that 33s could tumble quite quickly.
I'm just going to throw Eddie Howe into that mix as well.
Yeah.
It's not going to be an upward trajectory to the top. It doesn't happen like that. There will be growing pains. He's in unknown territory as a manager. He's never been in this position before. I'm not massively impressed with their recruitment. Dan, you'll advise better than me, but Matt Target...
solid.
Well, that's the thing. You might sort of solidify a bit of a mid-table position.
But don't you think they're doing... Newcastle have took me by surprise with the way they've done business, because I thought it might be a bit scattergun, but actually it's quite measured and it does feel like they're doing things quite gradually and they're not prepared to overpay. And in a way, I quite respect what they're doing.
Yeah, potentially. We'll see what they do in the next few weeks. They might go crazy, might they, as the window draws to a close. But yeah, I'd put him as an outside bet. I mean, obviously it'll be Ralph Hasenhüttl.
20-1.
20-1, yeah.
There you go. 20-1 and a 33-1 shot in the sack race.
I disagree with you both, actually, on the manager front. I think Arteta will stay out the season with Arsenal. I think they've gone too heavy with him. And I think Eddie Howe's probably... I don't see Newcastle finishing any lower than 10th. And I think as long as he does that, I think he'll be okay. But we'll see.
We've got Rodgers. You've obviously taken the short price Fav, so no surprise there. But we've got Rodgers, Arteta, and
he was 7-1 when I last looked, Rodgers.
So yeah, Lampard's the favourite, which I think is...
probably fair.
Well, I think even though I'm not a huge Lampard, I mean, as I've already said, I'm not a big fan of his, there does seem to be a unity between Everton fans and Lampard at the moment, off the back of the survival last season that I think would buy him some time. Whereas, given the disappointment of Leicester last season, Rodgers doesn't have that. I think Jesse Marsh doesn't have that either, after Leeds' pretty catastrophic stumble towards safety at the back end of last season. I don't think many Leeds fans credit Marsh with being the reason behind that. And he's another one where I think if things got off to a bad start, especially because of the amount of money that they've spent with the Calvin Phillips money effectively this summer, there's nowhere for him to hide if things go wrong, and lead to another club who are going to be absolutely desperate, as we saw with them parting company with Bielsa, the godfather of Leeds United. There's very little chance of them hanging around to see if Marsh is going to turn it around.
Just quickly before we go, then let's look at the TV games this weekend. So it's a Friday 8 o'clock kickoff for Crystal Palace against Arsenal. On Saturday, Liverpool travel to Fulham at the lunchtime kickoff, 12:30. Saturday tea time sees Everton v Chelsea. And then Sunday at 2 o'clock, we've got Manchester United v Brighton. And at 4:30, we have West Ham against Man City. All that's left to do is for me to thank the guys for joining me today. So thanks ever so much, Tim. And thank you, George, for chatting to me as ever. It's been an enjoyable show.
Thank you, mate. Loved it.
Cheers, Dan.
So that's all for the first preview show of the season. We'll be here every Friday throughout the season. And don't forget that Mark Chapman will be back on this feed on Monday, hosting the Athletic Football Podcast 4 times a week, giving you the best insight into the biggest stories across the game.
The Athletic.